For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host Red Sail, and this week we'll be taking a look at some more of the books shortlisted for this year's Yoto Carnegie Medal. Katya Balin helps us find some inner city wilderness and ponders our possessions in October, October. Phil Earle takes us to London during the Blitz, where a gorilla changes the life of an angry boy in When the Sky Falls. And Sue Divin looks to bridge sectarian divides in her Derry-based debut, Guard Your Heart. That's all coming up on today's Read On. The Carnegie Medal is the world's oldest prize recognising outstanding works of children's literature, and the list of former winners includes many of the best-loved children's authors of all time. This year, the award has a new sponsor, Yoto, whose products bring the joy of audiobooks to even the youngest readers. 6 of the 8 shortlisted books are based on real-world events, with many demonstrating the power of friendship to help young people overcome challenges and celebrate difference. The result will be announced on the 16th of June, and Read On has already been focusing on the books in contention. First up for this second show, October, October by Katya Balin has been described as a classic in the making for anyone who ever longed to be wild. It's a tender and beautifully written story of family, nature, imagination, and the fear that comes with change, written from the point of view of an 11-year-old girl whose life is turned upside down when her father has a serious accident. Katya joined me to tell us more.
So October, as the book starts, has just turned 11, and she lives off-grid, which means that she and her father don't have access to electricity like we do. They have to make their own solar panels and store it in batteries. They grow all of their own food, and she doesn't go to school. So they're really isolated and cut off from the outside world. They just live wild in these woods. They have a house which they built themselves, but, you know, essentially it's just the two of them taking care of nature and being part of nature, and she loves it. It's her ideal life. She doesn't want or need anything from the outside world, but she's never experienced it either.
And the only upset or anger in her life is that her mother is not there with them. She left when October was 4 years old.
Yes, she couldn't handle being wild. It's a beautiful life, but it's a really hard life. You know, you think if you want to eat something, you've got to grow it. If you want to be warm, you've got to chop wood and burn it. You know, you've got to rely on the power of the sun so that you can switch something on, like a kettle or whatever. So everything that we do quite naturally, perhaps, has an extra stage or 10 stages. And so she couldn't handle it. She left. And October is furious about this because she just thinks, who wouldn't want to live like this? And she refused to go with her mother, and she refuses to see her mother because this fury just burns inside her. And I think that people's reactions to October's mother has been really interesting, because so many people are like, I would have done the same thing, or they say, what a terrible parent. And I didn't write her to be a terrible parent, but some people do think that.
No, I mean, the whole nub of this book is about a sense of belonging, and the more we go through the book, we realise that whilst October absolutely belongs in the woods, living as part of nature, her mother doesn't belong there. She very much belongs in her London existence.
Yeah, I mean, I hope that there is a sort of sense of sympathy created for the mother. And I definitely didn't want this perfect mother figure, because I think in literature, often mothers are seen as sacrificing all of themselves for their children, or for the men around them sometimes. And I didn't want that. I wanted her to have done something for her because she had to, because she didn't belong. But she carries an enormous amount of guilt, which I think is why she, you know, she is so patient. She puts up with so much of this fury from October. But she never truly left. She does try to have this relationship with her daughter, but October just can't see past her anger and her fury, because she's so convinced that the woods are perfect and this is the perfect place, and how could anybody not belong there?
And as you say, the mother has never given up entirely, and she returns for October's 11th birthday. And this sets in train a series of events that mean that October must go to London with her mother, rather kicking and screaming, where she finds it very difficult to find any sense of belonging.
Yes, I mean, she's never been anywhere other than the woods, other than once a year they go to the village to do a huge shop and stock up on supplies, things like clothes and books and stuff that they can't grow themselves. But she's, you know, London is quite a sensory overload for a lot of people, let alone if you've never seen more than about 10 people in one place before. And it's just this complete culture shock for her. And she's not with her dad. She's always with her dad. She's had nature ripped away from her. She can't see how she'll ever be sort of wild and free and happy again. And interestingly, a lot of people say, oh, October, it must be neurodivergent. Because, yeah, I do a lot of work with neurodivergent people, and I guess maybe some people make that connection, or maybe it's just on their own, because of the way that she reacts to all of this sensory input. But I didn't intend that at all. I think I just thought that this child is just essentially, she's just never been exposed to anything. She's never eaten a Mars bar. She's never been on a bus. How would those things feel if you'd never done them before? It would be completely and utterly overwhelming.
Yes, that real sense of overload that October has when she moves to London, she feels imprisoned by it, and that's reflected in the fate of her pet owl Stig, who has to be taken to a wildlife centre, and his misery rather reflects her sense of imprisonment and inability to find somewhere to be wild in the city.
Yes, my editor had this wonderful idea of using illustrations, which I appreciate isn't the most appropriate thing here, of Stig growing and developing whilst not being mentioned on the page. And it was only when she said that I thought, oh, yeah, of course, they're developing in parallel. So it's so funny how you can write something and not see what's staring you smack bang in the face, you know, that actually their journeys do run in parallel. October finds Stig in the woods as a baby, and her dad says, no, leave that owl alone. You've got to let nature take its course. It's not fair for you to take something that's meant to be wild and free and to tame it. You know, if its mother's died, then that's life and death. But October does it anyway, and her dad then sort of goes, oh, okay, right, we'll support you. And then, of course, October is taken away from her wild and where she thinks she needs to be. And I mean, I don't want to say too much about the book, but it is both of them just sort of trying to do their best, I suppose, and trying to find their place when their place has changed and doesn't suit them anymore. And how they can make their peace with that, how they can get the best out of it, how they can find those little bits of wildness where they are.
This book is a book about resilience and, as you say, finding your place in a world that might not necessarily suit your view of how the world should be. And October manages to find freedom and wildness on the banks of the River Thames with Yusuf in mudlarking. For any listeners who aren't familiar with the term, can you tell us what mudlarking involves?
So it started off Victorian ages or before. Children would go down to the banks of the Thames when the tide was out, because it's a tidal river, and they'd go and pick up what they could to sell or to use, because obviously, you know, these children were living in extreme poverty. And now people do it as a hobby because the river is tidal. Every time the tide comes in, it leaves something new on the shore and then reveals it like the sort of carpet of history. And you can find things that haven't been touched or seen for hundreds or thousands, or in some cases, millions of years. Somebody I know found a mammoth tooth. And I just think that's incredible. But obviously, in October, she loves to find stories everywhere. She loves to find objects in the woods. And mudlarking is a way to connect her old life with her new life, because she starts to find all of these things that have these stories attached to them. And she's doing it in, you know, in the middle of a big grey city.
And it also reinforces the idea that what people might view as rubbish, as throwaway, does have an intrinsic value and does have a backstory, and it encourages that view of value and acceptance that runs through the book.
Absolutely. And I'm not particularly good at mudlarking. I do it, but I'm a bit rubbish. But, you know, there are things that people spot that 99.9% of people wouldn't care about, see, notice, but then you pluck them out and it's a coin from the Roman times, or a mammoth tooth, or it's a medal from a soldier from World War One. And I just think that being able to appreciate these little moments of history is really important when the rest of the world just goes rushing by. That said, I do have a load of bones glued into a frame in my study, and my partner absolutely hates it.
Well, I was going to ask you if you had actually been out mudlarking, and actually if you'd lived in the wilderness, because the parts of the book that really come alive, especially in the audiobook version, are the descriptive parts where you can hear the suck of mud on the wellies and you can almost smell the wood smoke. It's a real sensory feast, which for a blind reader makes you feel very much part of the book. It's not just visual, it's every sense being stimulated by the wilderness around the characters.
Oh, thank you. That's a really lovely thing to hear. I think I am a very sensory writer, and I think writing with only one sense would quickly prove quite boring for me and quite boring for the reader. So I really like to try and look at things in different ways and think about all the different impacts that they have on their environment. You know, how does it smell? How does it feel? How might somebody perceive this, not just visually? And how might they respond to that? So obviously I have been mudlarking, and I do live in London, and I love London, and I moved away for a little while, and all I could think about was just wanting to return. I think once it's in you and in your bones, there's nowhere quite like it, and maybe you don't appreciate that until you leave. So it was almost like a reverse of October. But my partner's father lives in the woods. When his wife died about 10 years ago, he just decided that he was going to do something he'd always wanted to do. So he bought 40 acres of woodland and built a house. And now that's just where he is all the time. And he makes his own electricity, and all of his heat comes from a kind of Arga type thing, which is plumbed into the heating. So if the fire's on, then the heating's on type thing. He grows a lot of, not all of his own food, but a lot of his own food. And I have spent a lot of time there, and I really love being there. It's very magical and very peaceful, but I couldn't live there. It's too hard, and I feel too far away, too disconnected from the veins and arteries of London and everything that gives me.
As we've mentioned, the book is beautifully narrated by Aisha Khala, who really catches that immediacy of October's language. In many ways, we can tell by October's voice that she hasn't had formal schooling. Her words tumble out of her, and it's not an easy job for a narrator to be able to read that, but Aisha gets it spot on. Did you have any input over choosing her, and does she sound like the October in your imagination when you were writing the book?
So I did have some input. I usually get sent 3 or 4 different actors, voice artists, and I get to say my preference, and I definitely chose Aisha. I thought she was brilliant. It's very hard to say whether she sounds like my October, because when I write, I don't imagine what my characters look like at all. I don't really even imagine what places look like. I suppose I'm just sort of writing from a really sensory way, but with characters, I guess the vision and the sound of them is never really in my head. I know that some writers, you know, their characters appear before them and they can hear them and they can see them, and I just can't. So I think that she has done a fantastic, brilliant job, and she is October. She wasn't necessarily what I imagined, but she's better. I always think that whenever I hear someone reading my work or I see a drawing, I'm like, that's really great. It hits the right spot, but I'm just not really capable of doing it myself.
He pushes back a matted curtain of sedge and stoops down. Come and see this, he says. And I hop down and peer into the dark, because maybe he's found more treasures stirred from the soil. It's an owl. A tiny feathered speck of baby owl. A white heart shape just starting to print on its face. Wide eyes. A minuscule flick of a beak. Fat, fragile chest. dipped in a quiver of soft puffs from its head to the tips of its folded wings. I reach out my fingers towards it, but Dad catches my hand gently and shakes his head. "We have to leave it. Another owl might come back for it, and if we take an owl this little..." His voice fades off and I want to snatch the unspoken words out of his mouth and throw them into the darkening sky, because I don't want to leave this owl hidden in bruised leaves and all alone.
Aisha Kala narrating October, October, written by my guest, Katya Balin.
Now, Katya, as we've mentioned, the book is beautifully illustrated by Angela Harding. I hear that the cover is an absolute feast for the eyes. Could you describe it to us?
Oh, absolutely. It is incredibly beautiful, and I'm very, very, very lucky that Angela agreed to work on the book because I think she's magnificent. It's a woodcut style. I believe actually it's lino printing. So it's lots of slightly abstract lines and shapes, but they all come together to make up on the front cover this beautiful woodland scene with the profile silhouette of a girl, but not particularly clear. You can't see facial features or anything like that. And she's staring into the woodland, and above her is this huge owl, massively out of proportion, but you know, perfectly judged, if that makes sense. And then on the back cover, the woods kind of merge into the city. And again, there's lots of fine detail in all of the lines, but it's not absolutely that's London. You can just see like the edge of Tower Bridge type thing. And the colours are very autumnal. There's lots of yellows and oranges. It's both bright and dark, if that makes sense. There are these beautiful melding of bright sort of autumnal colours, and then there's little pockets of darkness, particularly as you go towards the city. And it is amazing.
Another key theme that runs through the book is the importance of storytelling, both the stories we tell ourselves and the stories we end up believing. And as you've already said, one of the reasons October and her father go into town once a year is to pick up books for her to read. But there's very much a sense that also storytelling is an oral tradition. So you must be doubly chuffed that you have been shortlisted for the Carnegie Medal this year, where it is all about making stories and books available to all children, no matter what their economic background or physical ability to be able to read.
Obviously, it's just incredible to be shortlisted for the Carnegie, but mostly, above all, for those reasons. I have always worked in particular with children who are neurodivergent or who have a particular range of disabilities. And most of my work with them has been around literature, reading stories together, telling stories together as a way of, I mean, I'm not a therapist, but I suppose it is sort of quite a therapeutic intervention that I was doing with them. And so it is really, you know, inclusivity in literature, and every child and every adult, you know, being able to access the books that they want to read is just so important to me. And I'm so thrilled that, you know, mine are available in that way. It's wonderful.
Katya, thank you so much for taking us deeper into the woods and onto the foreshore of the River Thames and explaining a bit more about October, October.
Thank you so much.
October, October by Katya Balin is out now in print, ebook, and audio wherever you buy your books, and available in Braille from the RNIB Library. And Katya will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life. You're listening to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews, and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, Sue Diven introduces us to Derry's answer to Romeo and Juliet. But first, here's Hannah Tauss.
When the Sky Falls by Phil Earle is the heartbreaking story of Joseph, sent to London during the Blitz to stay with a friend of his grandmother's, Mrs. F, who runs the remains of a closed zoo. Angry at the world and unable to see the kindness in others, Joseph must contend with the no-nonsense Mrs. F, the tyrannical headmaster of his new school, Mr. Grice, and his persistent schoolmate, Sid. But perhaps his greatest challenge is Adonis, a silver-backed gorilla, and whether Joseph is capable of shooting him should the bombing release him from his enclosure. Phil Earle joined me to explain the true story behind the tale.
So When the Sky Falls was my 20th published book in my 10th year as a writer, and it is a historical novel which was inspired by a true story that a friend of mine told me out of the blue one night, sat around a campfire. He told me a story about his dad during World War II. Now, his dad wasn't allowed to fight because he had chronic asthma. So as a result, he was part of Manchester's Home Guard. And every time the air raid siren rang in Manchester, he had one job, which was to grab a rifle and run to Manchester Zoo. Well, Bellevue Zoo, it was called. And his job was simple. All he had to do was sit there all night, regardless of the weather, with his rifle trained through the bars of the lion's cage. Because if the Nazis dropped a bomb that fell on the zoo and it blew out the wall to the lion's cage, his dad's job was to shoot the lion before it went on the rampage, killing goodness knows how many. And that was the moment for me. That was the moment when it literally felt like somebody had plugged me into the mains. I knew there was a story there that I wanted to write down. The only question I had to ask was, what if? What if, you know, that rifle ended up in the arms of an angry 12-year-old boy instead of a responsible adult? And what if the animal inside the cage wasn't a lion anymore, but an angry, aggressive, surly, silverback gorilla? The sort of animal that was almost like a mirror image of the boy. So by the end of the story, I knew that bombs would be falling. I knew that rifle would be in this boy's hands. And I knew that he'd be left with a really big decision, which is, could he and would he possibly pull the trigger on the one thing in his life that's really ever loved him? So that's in essence what the story is about.
So you have Joseph, who, unlike most of the other children during the Blitz, was sent out of London, is actually sent into London by his grandmother. His father has gone to war. His mother has abandoned him some years ago. And he has just this huge amount of rage, which you can palpably feel. How did you manage to tap into that sense of anger so accurately?
I've been told that a lot of my best writing is when I'm writing about angry young men. The first book I had published was 11 years ago now, called Being Billy. And that came as a result of working with young people. I was very fortunate in that I worked in a children's home in Hull, looking after young people that weren't allowed to live at home because their parents had problems with, you know, alcohol or substances or violence. And a lot of those young people, especially the young men, were very, very angry. But what I loved about them was their resilience, their determination, their ability to break out from this sort of cycle of abuse almost that they were stuck in. So it tapped into that. And I think also, without me realizing it, I wrote the book at a difficult time in my life. I was struggling. I wasn't making a lot of sense of the world. It felt like everything was pretty unfair. And as a result, I think I tapped into a lot of those things that were going on for me at the same time without realizing. But it worked. It allowed me to access those feelings, I think.
I have to admit that Mrs. F, who is the person who looks after Joseph when he gets to London and is in charge of the remains of the zoo, shall we say?
Yeah.
She's my favourite character in the book. Was she based on anybody you know, or was she created entirely within your own imagination?
I mean, large swathes of her are purely imaginative. You know, I mean, there are aspects of various relatives that I've got in her. She has a tendency, I think, to say on a couple of occasions, my hand's itching. And my auntie June always used to say that to me. If she was babysitting for me when I was little and I was being a bad lad, she used to say, my hand's itching, Philip. So I think invariably people like that sort of enter into your psyche. But no, I mean, I wanted her to be, again, like Adonis the gorilla is a mirror image of Joseph. I wanted Mrs. F to be that as well. You know, she's lost something like Joseph, like Adonis, like Sid, even like Mr. Grice, the horrible headmaster in the story. They've all lost something. They all feel like they've been abandoned. So largely she was made up, I think.
You slowly peel away the layers of all of your characters bit by bit. What you first see is not what you necessarily get by the end.
Yeah.
And Joseph has difficulty seeing past the initial appearance of people. How did you pace the secrets and discoveries throughout it so it didn't feel like it was roller coastering, but was more of a steady build?
Yeah, I think it's with a lot of help from a very good editor, really. I think as well, I mean, for me, it's interesting, isn't it? Because when you talk to a lot of writers, they often talk about the fact that the best advice they can give to young writers is to read. And whilst that's impossible to disagree with, for me, there's more to it than that. I mean, I wasn't a huge reader as a young person, but what I was I just loved stories. I loved absorbing stories. I still love going to the cinema or watching a film at home. It is my favourite thing to do. And so I think I learned an awful lot from that classic three-act structure. And teachers often talk about it as a story mountain, you know, this notion of a character goes on a journey, which is the mountain. They climb up to the top. At the top, there's the sort of the dilemma, the thundery moment at the top that they have to solve. And then there's the resolution and the ending on the downslope. But often you get it wrong. This is the wonderful thing about writing, is that the first thing that you commit to the page doesn't have to be the thing that makes the final book. You can edit, you can tinker, you can start again, you can be advised. And so, yeah, it was trial and error a lot, making sure that not just Joseph's secrets, but also Sid's, Mrs. F's and Adonis's, that all their secrets came out in a way that didn't feel like you were just being hit between the eyes again and again with revelation after revelation. It's tinkering and practice, I think.
Now, I have a bit of a bone to pick with you, I'm afraid.
Oh, well, okay.
I was sobbing so much. I mean, full-on snot bubbles, the lot. Do you think that younger readers will have the same reaction that some of the adults have about the book?
It's a great, great question, because that was something that I thought about a lot when I was writing it. If I'm completely honest, it's hard to word this well, but I never feel like I'm writing for children. I'm writing for me. I'm writing the book that I would like to read. I am my first reader. I'm the first person that will read what I've written. And so I'm looking at ultimately for a story that's going to grip me and entertain me. And I think hopefully the emotions that you're writing about are universal. We all lose someone. And if you're a child, then hopefully it's not someone that's very close to you. It might be a pet, for example. But those themes of loss and abandonment are real, whatever age you are. And it's been, honestly, I've just had the best year of my life writing, you know, writing life with this book, because the number of teachers that have got in touch with me to say that they've read it with their class has just been astonishing. And I remember, honestly, really, really clearly, when I was in year five at junior school, so, you know, I'd be probably being 9, maybe 10, my teacher, Mr. Parr, would read to us every day. And one of the books we read was a book called I Am David by Anne Holm. It's a World War II book. It's about a refugee trying to escape across the border. And I can't remember a lot of what that book is about, but I remember so clearly that at the end, there's a German shepherd dog that helps this boy in his quest, and the dog sacrifices itself. And I remember looking around me and seeing my classmates crying. And although it didn't make me cry, I'll never forget that moment of, gosh, that's what stories can do. They can be that powerful. They can transport you somewhere else. And so I didn't set out to make people sob, but if people can relate to it and empathise with it, then that feels like a really precious thing.
Now, you brilliantly bring in the issue of dyslexia without actually naming it. You talk about letters and words dancing on the page. How important is it to you that people who are print disabled have access to books?
It's just, I think for people that don't live with any sort of sight loss, you can't possibly imagine how limiting, how frustrating it might be. And one of my other books, The Bubble Wrap Boy, was recorded, I think, for the RNIB, which was, it's an honour, really, isn't it? It felt very, very important within the story that Joseph faced as many obstacles as he could, that he really felt like the world was conspiring against him. And I've been lucky enough over my writing career to work a lot with Barrington Stoke, the publisher who are based up in Edinburgh, who they solely publish books for people that are reluctant readers or dyslexic. And it's been the single biggest honour of my writing career to work with them, because although I'm not dyslexic, or not that I've ever been diagnosed as dyslexic, I have always found reading very, very difficult, not to do with my sight, just to do with my attention span more than anything. When you start to research and you look into the different forms of dyslexia that there are, it's hard to believe that, again, there are videos on YouTube you can watch which show you, which recreate what it's like for people, whether it's almost like a boat bobbing on the sea, you know, and how infuriating and frustrating and disheartening, and how it must make you feel, for want of a better word, thick, or what's wrong with me. So it felt like a really good way of layering another challenge onto Joseph's life. And the single biggest irony, I think, at the end of the book, because I try not to give any answers to that side of the story, because, of course, dyslexia had been, you know, people knew of it as a term in the 1940s. They really didn't know what to do with it or how to treat it. And ironically, just after I finished writing the book, I found that two of my three children are dyslexic, and we weren't able to get that diagnosed until they were sort of 14 and 11. So it really brought it home to me, just the struggle that they must have had. So now the opportunity to make any noise or to bang any drum about people that are struggling with sight, it feels very important, but it feels like an honour as well.
Well, coming on to that, you have the brilliantly narrated audiobook done by yourself. How challenging was it to read your own words out loud?
Do you know what? It's been on my bucket list as a writer. You know, I've been lucky in a few of my other books have been turned into audiobooks, but I just didn't get brave enough to ask if I could record them. This book feels very special to me. You know, it came at a tricky time, and I'm very invested in the storyline and its contents. And I just thought, you know what, I'm just going to get brave for once and ask if I can do it. So I did. And they were very, very accommodating. And they said, don't worry, we'll book you 3 days in a studio, and that should be more than enough time for you to get it done. And we did it in a day and a half. It was incredible. It was just the most rewarding, infectious experience. You know, I just wanted to keep doing it. It felt like a massive privilege. And I'm not sat there like someone on Jack and Ori. Like when I was a kid, there was this program called Jack and Ori where they tell you a story and there were brilliant actors doing it. I wasn't trying to do the funny voices or anything. And I certainly wasn't doing a gorilla impression, that's for sure. And I absolutely loved it. It felt like a massive thrill and a massive honour to be allowed to do that. And I've been down again the last couple of months, down to London to record the next book as well.
Joseph, is that who you are? A face craned over his shoulder and into view, too close to focus on. He couldn't see the chin strap of a policeman's helmet, just a shocking frizz of greying red hair that sprung in all directions. I'm here to collect you, lad. A woman, a hard face, lived in, and a deep, gravelly voice. The boy looked in her eyes and dared her to look back. She did, and seemed about as happy to be there as he was. Don't know what you're talking about, missus. I'm just leaving, sending me to the country they are, with the others. The woman gripped harder at the strap. With an accent like that, I don't think so, Joseph.
Phil Earle narrating his book, When the Sky Falls.
And you're continuing with the themes of animals in your next book, aren't you?
Yeah. When I was editing When the Sky Falls, my editor, who is nothing short of a genius, a fabulous person called Charlie Shepherd, Charlie said to me during the first round of edits, that just be careful, Phil, you don't give too many characters pets, because, of course, don't forget, not many people had pets during World War II. And I had no idea what she was talking about. And she told me this story that in September 1939, as war was about to break out, the government sent a booklet, a 30-page booklet, called Air Raid Precautions, Volume 10, Precautions for Animals, I think it was called. And it sounds riveting, doesn't it? It sounds dreadful. And it basically said, look, when war starts, it's not going to be safe for your animals. There'll be bombs falling, there'll be dust, gas, flames, explosions. There won't be enough food for humans, let alone animals. So unless you can evacuate your animals like you would your children, we recommend that you have them put to sleep. And in this booklet, there are even illustrations of cattle and sheep and horses with crosshairs trained on their heads to show you where to shoot your animal in the most painless fashion. And as a result, in September 1939, 750,000 animals were put to sleep, which I just find astonishing. And we are obviously a nation of animal lovers. But if you look at the stats for the number of British soldiers that died in the whole of the war, you're talking about something like 370,000 soldiers. So twice that number of animals died in 30 days. So again, I just started asking myself a question. I just said, what if, you know, what if there was one boy who refused to do what the government told him? What if there was one boy who decided to save as many animals as he could? So this boy called Noah with his couple of mates, they nick his dad's boat, which is nothing more than a bathtub, really. They fill it with animals and they try and sail it down the Thames because that's where they think this duchess lives. There was a famous duchess during World War II called Lady Nina Douglas Hamilton. And she was an anti-vivisectionist and animal rights activist. And she said, when World War II broke out, don't have your animals put to sleep, bring them to me. So these kids sail this boat down the river thinking they're sailing down to the Duchess's estate. And the story, it's called While the Storm Rages, is about whether they can save these animals or not.
Oh, I'm looking forward to that one. Unless, of course, it involves far more sobbing, which I have a feeling that it might do. Yeah,
I can't deny there might, there might be moments for which I am already apologising profusely.
Well, Phil Earle, thank you so much for talking to us. Congratulations on being shortlisted for the Yoto Carnegie. And despite the tears, I would recommend it to everyone.
Bless you. Thanks so much. I've really enjoyed chatting to you. Thank you.
When the Sky Falls by Phil Earle is available in audio commercially or in Braille from the RNIB Library.
Thanks, Hannah. You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Connect Radio. Still to come in this Carnegie Medal special episode, Sue Diven is a writer and peace worker who's based in Northern Ireland. She has a career in community relations, and her writing often probes issues around diversity and reconciliation. Guard Your Heart is her first novel, and is a modern-day Romeo and Juliet story set across the sectarian divide of Derry, Londonderry, from where Sue herself joined me.
Sue Diven, welcome to Read On.
Thank you very much.
As I said in my introduction, this is a modern day take on Romeo and Juliet, set in 2016. Could you introduce us to your star-crossed lovers, please?
Yes, absolutely. So, as you say, they're both 18 and they're both actually born on the day of the Good Friday peace deal. We're meeting them 18 years later, but that's important because these are two characters from the northwest of Northern Ireland who have not lived a single day of their lives in the Troubles, but yet their lives are still impacted by the legacy of the Troubles. So Aidan is a young lad from Creggan, which is quite a socially deprived area in the city. He's had a really tough time growing up. He is Irish, nominally Catholic, but not really religious, and he's Republican. So politically, he believes in a united Ireland and he's quite into community politics. Iona is 18. She's from the Protestant or British identity within the city. She has an integral family around her, a couple of brothers, a mum and a dad, whereas on Aidan's side, his mum has actually died of cancer and he's living just with his older brother. And his dad, who was quite a tough person to grow up with, is no longer on the scene. So he's very much on his own. And really, the story spawns out of the fact that these two characters meet. There's a hate crime incident where Aidan is attacked in a sectarian attack, and Iona is a witness to that, and she films it on a phone, so she has evidence, and that's the start of their connection.
This is very much a book about empathy, what we've got in common, and it's also very important that this book was written about two characters who have only known peace in Northern Ireland. You're wanting to focus on the struggle for peace rather than the Troubles themselves.
Yes, it's very much a story for today's generation and young people today, or adults who are interested in learning about Northern Ireland today. So it's not set in the Troubles at all. And the empathy thing is important, perhaps not just the empathy that the characters develop amongst themselves, but for empathy as a reader. So a lot of people who read Guard Your Heart might have very limited or next to no knowledge about Northern Ireland. And really what I'm trying to do is use fiction as a way to promote empathy. So I believe that fiction is a really powerful tool for creating empathy. I also, in my day job, I work in peace and reconciliation with diverse communities in Derry, and I believe that empathy is a powerful tool for peace. So when you combine fiction that can inspire empathy and empathy working for peace, I'm really hoping that this book will challenge readers to think either about what they've been told about here or what they don't know about here as part of the UK or as part of these islands that we live in, and wider across the world, to think about diversity, human rights, peace building, the fact that peace building takes guts, it takes courage.
You say that fiction is maybe a better way of building empathy than, say, history. Is that because, though you are using a real context, a real place, Derry in this case, by fictionalizing the characters, you're depersonalizing the story, you're making it more universal?
Absolutely. Fiction is a safe space to explore diverse perspectives, diverse viewpoints on difficult issues that are not just religious, but cultural, political, colonial, historical, identity-based issues, I suppose, and how you look at identity conflict. Interestingly, a lot of the younger readers in the Carnegie, I've seen references made to Noughts and Crosses, which to me makes perfect sense as a parallel for someone trying to understand Northern Ireland, because sectarianism is actually a form of racism. That's how it's defined. So for people to relate to the Black Lives Matter movement or books like The Hate U Give by Angie Thomas, those are books that I see as having similarities. Whilst they are different too, there are similarities in how people can relate to the issues. And I think it's really important that they are universal issues and understood that way.
As you say, you've got a master's degree in peace and conflict studies and a decade and a half of working within your local community to try and build empathy and understanding of the differences between the communities in Derry. But I've read something very self-deprecating that you said, that you have no formal training in writing. Can you tell us how you came to write? It's not the normal path that authors might follow. You certainly didn't go to a creative writing course or anything.
No, well, let's celebrate not having to do traditional and conventional paths.
Yes.
I mean, I always did enjoy creativity. I've always been a creative person. When I was at school, I mean, my highest qualification to do with writing is an A level in English literature. So I do have that. But I studied European studies at university. So that was, you know, languages, history, politics. I went into teaching. Again, I wasn't teaching English. It was history and learning for life and work, which is like citizenship type stuff. So I really got into writing kind of accidentally. I'd written chronic poetry when I was a teenager at school. I did do a bit of singer-songwriting in my 20s. And in my sort of later years, shall we say, more recently, I became a single parent through a whole range of circumstances and found myself just stuck in the house in the evenings after work, no babysitters, and really just house was a bit of a prison in the evening. So after a couple of years, I decided I'd had enough telly, switch it off. And I got an idea for a book and I started to write. And I didn't actually tell a soul that I was writing until I got to the end of a first draft and then thought, right, I'd better work out what to do with this now, because I have what seems to be a potentially good book here, but I don't know what to do with it. And so I started at that point in connecting in with the writing world and finding my way into things. And it was a competition route that actually got my book published. I put it into a couple of competitions. One was the Caledonia Novel Award based out of Edinburgh, and it got shortlisted in that through to the final six. And it made the final, or joint winner, if you like, of the Irish Novel Fair, which is an international novel competition out of Dublin. And that's like a dragon's den where you pitch your book to prospective publishers and agents. And thankfully, one of them liked it and she got me the book deal. So that's how I got into writing.
And the book has been hugely successful. And now it's been shortlisted for the Yoto Carnegie Medal. I mean, it must be a dream come true for you.
It feels miraculous. I mean, debut authors are not meant to be shortlisted for this award. So I'm just thrilled to be at the party, you know. I looked it up. As far as I can tell, it's difficult to get the information, but I think C.S. Lewis in 1953 was probably the only Northern Irish winner of it. I can't access who has been shortlisted. And in 2009, there was a book called Bogchild by Siobhan Dowd, who is of Irish descent. And she wrote a book that was set in Northern Ireland and won the Carnegie with that. But it's a rare thing for someone from Northern Ireland and a very rare thing for a debut author to actually make the shortlist. So, yeah, it's unbelievable.
And it's wonderful to hear so many good news stories coming out of Derry. We've all been glued to our TV sets watching Derry Girls recently, and it shows Derry in a far more positive light than we got used to during the time of the Troubles and since. You must feel rather proud of your community for being as resilient and upbeat.
I mean, Derry Girls obviously is the icing on the cake. Everybody is delighted with Derry Girls, and I think the final episodes were just fantastic. I think one of the questions I often ask school groups is, where did you get your information from Northern Ireland or about Northern Ireland? And if they have had their information from anywhere, it will only be the news. And the news only shows negative stuff from Northern Ireland. Most of the other stuff never makes the national news. I mean, for example, Derry in 2013 was the UK City of Culture. It was the first ever UK City of Culture, and we have a stunning cultural sector here, a stunning landscape, which I hope I do a bit of justice to in the book as well. And it's such an amazing, vibrant, creative place. But you would never normally see that mentioned anywhere, because everything is just, it's like this reductionist Catholic Protestant violence thing, and that's all people expect to see from here. So that's all is ever shown from here. So it's nice to be able to show the complexity of peace building, and also some of the beautiful scenery we have here, and the humour and the turn of phrase and the resilience of our community. So yeah, there's lots of good stuff here.
Well, I for one can't wait for an audiobook version to be produced. Is there news?
Not that I know of. I would love there to be an audiobook version. So many people when I do readings ask me about an audiobook version, because they're hearing the language, the accent of here, you know, and I think it brings the characters across. But so far, I don't know of an audiobook version. I would love it if there's one.
We better prod the publishers, hadn't we?
Please do.
In the meantime, you've very kindly agreed to read us an extract from the beginning of the book. So over to you, Sue Diven.
Thank you. So the book is from two perspectives. So sometimes Aidan, the boy, is the key voice, and other times it's Iona. So chapter one is Aidan, and it's in June when he's just finishing his last exam. It was more miraculous than the virgin birth, me finishing sixth form. Not that I believe in holy miracles. Miraculous like the magic millisecond a girl says, yes, and you blurt, really? It was the kind of historic day you only have a handful of in a lifetime. Days that start out all innocent but end up life-changing, for good or bad. Ones that sneak up on you like an unexpected kiss or a kick in the teeth. To be honest, I'd already had my fill of them, mainly the bad kind. But this day was different. My last day of school, ever. One last politics exam, four rows of chairs, 14 pupils, 13 pages of my black ink scrawl and lined paper, one varnished assembly hall floor, 7 years of grammar school education. 3 minutes left. 3 minutes till freedom, or something. Mindlessly, I flicked through the exam paper, but my concentration was gone. I chewed my thoughts and my pen lids, gazing round at the wood panelling that gave the room its scent of musty polish. Dust danced in the shafts of sunlight, moving, changing, just out of reach. 2 minutes. Two Nobel Prize winners had escaped from these walls. Mr. Seamus Heaney, the famous Irish poet, Hope and Healing Wells and all that, and Mr. John Hume, the famous peacemaker politician from that Good Friday in 1998 when the North of Ireland finally brokered a peace deal. The exact day I'd been born. No pressure, like. Please God, I hadn't messed up the A-levels as badly as the GCSEs and my nuclear meltdown 2 years previously. Ironic that maybe I'd transformed my own troubles quicker than the country. Then again, I hadn't had 4 centuries of being screwed over, just 18 years.
Sue Diven, I think we've found the narrator. I don't think they're going to have to look any further than you. Would you like to read the audiobook version yourself if you were offered?
I wouldn't mind. A lot of people do say that when I do readings. I think it probably would be good to have a male narrator doing Aidan, but I think a local voice would be helpful.
It certainly gives it an immediacy. And I know that you are very committed to audiobooks because of your own family circumstances.
Yes, my mum is gradually losing her sight, unfortunately, through macular degeneration. So she has benefited a lot from RNIB services. She listens to audiobooks all the time. And prior to that, the large print books as well. And RNIB have been fantastic working with her as well on many different services. So yeah, I think they're really, really important.
Has she been able to read God, Your Heart, or have you read it to her already?
She has actually read it. It was one of the things early on when she knew the book existed. She was, could I get an advance copy? Could I see it now? Could I have it electronically so I can make it big on a screen? You know, and the second book that's come out more recently, again, she was keen to get the book as soon as she possibly can, because she can only read a certain amount at a time, you know, with a large magnifying glass and stuff. But she still loves to be able to hold the book. And she was just really worried she would have lost too much sight to be able to read the next book. But thankfully, she has been able to read it.
Authors are used to working to deadlines, but usually from publishers rather than parents.
Yes. The more interesting one is when there's subtle language in there and you kind of wonder, is your mum going to be OK with it? But yeah, I have told her it's YA. Compared to many other adult books, it really doesn't have a lot of language, but it is the upper end of YA. So there is a little bit.
It is certainly a story that is resonating with readers of all ages. Yeah, Sue Diven, many congratulations on all the success that Guard Your Heart has had. And I look forward to meeting you at the British Library in a few weeks' time.
Thank you very much, Red.
Guard Your Heart is available in Braille from the RNIB Library and in print wherever you buy your books. And Read On will, of course, bring you any news about an audio version. Now it's back to Katia Balin for the books of her life.
Katia, was there a book that you read as a youngster that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
So I think that the book that made me fall in love with reading was Pippi Longstocking. I think it's because it's one of the first books that I remember reading all on my own. And also because I wanted to be her. She's just completely anarchic. For anyone who doesn't know, Pippi Longstocking is the daughter of, she claims, a cannibal king. Actually, he's just sort of a king of some faraway island, but he sails the seven seas. But she lives on her own with a horse and a monkey called Mr. Nelson, and she doesn't go to school. And adults always try and make her go to school and to do things and go and live in a children's home. And she just won't. She's so strong she can lift a horse, but she's also just really funny and really clever and a bit daft, and she's just living this incredible life, like I say, all on her own. And as a child, I was just like, this is brilliant. It was the dream. I wanted to live on my own with a horse and a monkey. And she has good friends, and it's set in Sweden, so it's got this lovely sort of Scandinavian vibe, and it's just the best thing ever. But I think the book that made me want to write as opposed to read is probably Skellig by David Armand, because I just think it is book perfection. And every time I read it, I think it's more and more beautiful and I learn more and more from it.
She said we should never have left Random Road. We should never have come to this stinking derelict place. She walked back and forward in the kitchen with the baby in her arms. My little girl, she murmured. My poor little girl. The baby has to go back to hospital, Dad whispered. Just for a while, so the doctor can keep an eye on her, that's all. She'd be fine. He stared out of the window into the wilderness. I'll work harder, he said. I'll get it all ready for when she comes back again. I'll help, I said. But he didn't seem to hear.
Jim Norton narrating Skellig by David Armand, which is available from the RNIB Library.
And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Yes, absolutely. And it's The Moomins by Tove Jansson. Any of them, there are about 10 of the sort of main books and lots of spin-offs. But I have a particular fondness for one called Finn Family Moomin Troll. And I think it's because the books are so cozy and wonderful. The Moomins live in a place called Moomin Valley, and there are adventures absolutely everywhere. There's magic. There are just sort of unexpected things happen. Unexpected guests drop by. But it's not completely safe. You know, there are little bits of danger here and there, but ultimately, you know, it's going to be all right. And the characters are so varied as well. Lots of them are incredibly grumpy or naughty or mean. And again, I guess it's a bit anarchic, but that just makes the community so varied and brilliant. You know, nobody apologizes for being a bit a bit grumpy or a bit mean, you know, and everyone's just like, oh, that's who they are. And it's, I just love it. I want to live with them and get to fly on clouds and drink raspberry lemonade and find magic hats and camp by the river.
Letter to Children, written by Moomin Mama. Dear Children, when I first heard that the whole Finn Family Moomin Troll was going overseas I went to Mumin Papa and asked if I should pack the usual things we carry with us on our journeyings around. It's only the story about us and going abroad.
Andrew Timothy narrating Finn Family Moomin Troll by Tove Jansson, which is available from the RNIB Library.
Finally, is there a book you've read recently that you'd like to share with the listeners?
So I'm going to cheat. I've got two because I find it, it's like when someone asks what your favourite book is, I find it completely impossible. So I recently read a young adult book by Manon Stephan Ross. I hope I said that right. It's Welsh. And it's called The Blue Book of Nebo. And it's only recently been translated from the Welsh by the author herself. And it's just, the prose is so spare and brutal and beautiful. And it's about life after a big nuclear event where, you know, relatively few people have survived and there's no electricity and kind of society and communities as we know them have broken down, which makes it sound really, really grim. And in some ways it is, but it's also just about all the stuff of life, you know, love and loss and healing. And I just loved it. And the other is a middle grade book. It's called Wished by Lissa Evans. And again, I'm going to use the word anarchic because apparently that's the kind of book I like, but it's just got this kind of rare quality of feeling like this, an old classic, whilst also kind of addressing some quite modern themes and being very beautifully written, whilst also being really, really, really funny. And there's a great talking cat in it.
Dad has done something completely random. He bumped into Miss Filey at the recycling bins this morning and she suggested that we go to her house during the day for an entire week. Don't exaggerate, called Mum. You don't have to go at the weekend, so it's literally 5 days. Miss Filey? Asked Rue. Yes, unbelievable, isn't it? I've never been inside her house, said Rue. Nor me. Why would anyone want to? Well, it might be interesting. Rue said the last few words quietly. She never enjoyed contradicting Ed, who was a year and a half older than her, because Ed enjoyed arguing and was good at it, and she didn't and wasn't. But Miss Filey's house, at the bottom of the road, was intriguing.
Lissa Evans, narrating her book Wished, which is available commercially, although many of her other books are available from the RNIB Library.
Katya Balin, thank you so much for sharing your passion for reading with the listeners and for being a guest on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Alas, that's all we've got time for today. But Read On will be back at the same time next week. And you can always subscribe to the podcast by searching your favourite provider for Read On, the audiobook show. And why not follow us on Twitter? I'm at Red Sail, and Robert Kirkwood is at talking_books. Thanks to producer Hannah, to all my guests, and to you for listening. Farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.